And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we are going to be talking with one of the original researchers in the field of near-death studies, PMH Atwater. Her latest work, Dying to Know You, Proof of God in the Near-Death Experience. It's an amazing story. Stand by. She's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast PMH Atwater, one of the original researchers in the field of near-death studies, having begun her work back in 1978. And an international authority on the subject, as well as an experiencer who passed away three times. She is the author of 20-plus books and has served two terms on the International Association for Near-Death Studies Board. She is an accomplished runecaster specializing in the yin or feminine approach to the rune use, an astrologer, numerologist, spiritual visionary, and practical sensitive. PMH Atwater, back on Coast to Coast. Hey, PMH, how are you?
Well, by golly, I'm fine.
Well, that's good. It's good to get you back. It's been a year. Just about a year.
That's up to you. You know, you can always call me anytime. I have a phone number.
No doubt. Dying to Know You, huh? Your latest work?
Yes. And a very different kind of book.
Now, let me ask you this. What's so unusual about this one?
This book is by the collective, in the collective voice, about the collective experience. It's the only book out that is like that. It's all about the collective. You know, there's lots of personal stories now, bestsellers. There's that wonderful movie with Colton Burpo, the little 5-year-old who had a near-death experience. There's all these personal accounts, and they all grab us, and they're wonderful. But there's no book out at all, and never has been, about that. The collective talking about the collective through the voice of the collective. And you know, my research base is nearly 4,000 adults and children, and I've been there, speaking to all of these people, writing down what they've said for nearly four decades now. And, I've just been there listening to these people, and I've been writing it down, and finally I summed it. I just put it all together, their words, and that's that little book. And, you know, it's the littlest book I've ever written. It's just a tiny little thing, but yet it's powerful.
It gets the message across, doesn't it?
Wow! It does. And I never, ever, ever thought of doing, you know, a book like this. Just never occurred to me.
You're one of the giants, PMH, in this study. You know, you, Raymond Moody, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I mean, you folks are the giants. Elizabeth not with us anymore. Raymond still is. And in your case, you almost were not with us. You died three times. What happened?
Three times in 3 months. I call it the heavenly sledgehammer effect.
That's way too much. Three times in three. Was it the same thing or three different episodes?
They were all different. The first one was a miscarriage followed by extreme hemorrhaging. 2 days later, a major thrombosis in the right thigh vein, which dislodged, followed by the worst case of phlebitis the specialist had ever heard of, let alone seen. And then 3 months later, they still today don't know what killed me. They think maybe it might have been a heart attack, but they're not sure. You know, no vital signs. And then later that fall, three major relapses. So, you know, when we talk about near-death experiences, we tend to be a little bit, you know, maybe flamboyant or maybe adventurous in talking about these experiences, and we don't realize that most of them come from violence or trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you're through with the experience, the body isn't through with you, and you've got a body to rebuild. So, you know, I was one of those people that had to relearn how to crawl, how to stand, how to walk, how to climb stairs, how to run, tell the difference between left and right, see properly, hear properly, and rebuild all my belief systems. So for about a year, I was busy being human again. And then, you know, I'm glad you mentioned Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, because at the end of that year, I was I had taken a little vacation to Chicago, Illinois, to visit my aunt and uncle, and I was waylaid at O'Hare Airport, you know.
That's not unusual.
Yeah, and there was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I recognized her by her pictures, and I just walked up, introduced myself. And her plane was late, about an hour late. So we sat down on a little bench, the two of us just chatting away like a couple of schoolgirls. And I told her what had happened to me. And I just spelled it out, all three. And she validated me and said I was a near-death survivor. She never used the word experiencer. I was a survivor, and I really felt like a survivor. And she gave me the words, you know, near-death experience, because I'd never heard that before. I'd never heard of Raymond Moody or any of that kind of stuff. And, you know, that was wonderful being with Elizabeth. And we became friends after that. But it caused for me more questions than it gave answers. And that's when I launched. But when I launched my work, but, you know, in my third near-death experience, I was told to do this. And, you know, I've just been doing my work, been doing my job.
Last week, I had a question that I asked our audience, and that basically was, is there a God? And I told them specifically, PMH, you know, I didn't want to get religious. I don't want anybody reading from Scripture. I just want your feelings on, is there a God? And if there is, why? Tell us why. And it's almost like the question in your book, Dying to Know You, Proof of God and the Near-Death Experience. When you look at this vastness of the universe and everything that's happening, and then you try to put us into perspective in terms of why are we here? What are we doing here? How did we get here? You have got to come to the conclusion that there's some kind of higher power that had an influence here. I don't see any other way around it.
Well, with near-death experiencers, there's no doubt. 90 to 95% say yes to God. In the book, I call it God, Allah, Deity, honoring the three major ways of, you know, looking at God, speaking about God, naming God, so God, Allah, Deity. But, you know, even atheists who come back atheists, and there's some who do, wind up in some kind of atheist church, and by the way, there really is an atheist church, but they come back glowing, more compassionate, they come back different, as if they were touched by something very special, whether or not they want to call that God. But, you know, 90 to 95%, you know, you got to look at that, you know, children and adults, and even describing some of them, what God is or what God looked like or how God felt. And they're very specific about this. So it's just so powerful. Many of them come back, maybe with a different name for God, like light or presence or creator or Om or core or, you know, a universal essence, the nameless one, but still that sense of there's a greater intelligence, there's a greater pulse, there's that greater sense of movement and thought and beingness, and that's God. It's God. And you know, if you go over even further with this, and I get really excited when I talk about it, it's this sense of, it's like the God on the other side of death is not necessarily the God of Holy Writ. It's bigger than that. It's larger than that. It's more powerful than that. And you just got to talk about it. It's what I call the rooftop experience, where you're on the rooftop, like some kind of evangelist, and you're saying, God is, death isn't. You know, and the first 3 years after a near-death experience, really experiencers are still kind of over there yet. They haven't quite landed, and I remind them all about the first rule of discipleship, and that first rule is don't freak the natives. Yeah,
you know, that's true.
Yeah, yeah, ain't you? So you know, you've got to tone that down just a little bit. But most of them, adults, will talk about God in the sense of light. And they describe that light as brighter and more powerful than 10,000 suns. So we're talking voltage here. We're talking something, we're talking power, we're talking voltage. When children talk about God, that they still have that sense of gender. Most of them, not all of them, but most of them still have that sense of gender. And to a child, God is like a grandfatherly figure.
Yes, up in the clouds.
Well, not necessarily in the clouds, but something about a male or a father or a grandfatherly figure. But what just simply grabs you about children is they're not constrained like adults. And a child will look at this figure and they'll say, is this what you really look like? And instantly, there's that light. That figure bursts into this light, this incredible, powerful light. And people do the same thing with angels. And by the way, children are most often met by angels, and usually winged ones. And they'll say to the angel also, you know, is this what you really look like? And the same thing happens. They burst into this incredible light. Not quite as powerful and as big as God's light, but still light. You know, and kids talk about three different lights on the other side of death. Adults do, too, a great deal. That very raw, powerful, overly powerful light, just really, really raw, piercing light. And it doesn't have any particular color. More like a radiation or a luminosity. There's that particular light. Then there's a light that's dark or black, might have purple in it. And to a child and even to most adults, this light is warm and enriching and comfortable and protective and healing. There's something about this light that lifts you in incredibly warm and loving ways. And then there's this white light or this really bright, maybe gold and silver tinges to it, but this incredibly white light. And when they talk about that light, it's like that light is so big and so, you know, just awesome kind of light.
Well, when you talk of 90 to 90% of the near-death experiencers returning, you know, believing, being convinced that there is a God, what do you think the percent was before they died? Any idea? That's an interesting question, isn't it?
In my research base, I would have to say that maybe two-thirds,
Okay, so there was an
might
increase.
Might have had some concept of God before, and maybe of those two-thirds, maybe about half of them or less went to church. But afterward, I want to correct your word believe, because an experiencer returns knowing there's a God. There's no belief factor involved at all.
They're totally convinced, aren't they?
But before, you know, belief, yes, maybe about a half to two-thirds, but 90 to 95% knowing afterward. So to me, that's really big. Yeah, that's a really big difference. And, you know, it's just, it's so deep. For me, it's like my next breath is God. It's like every breath is God. It's like the reason I do all this work is God. Where did my energy come from? God. You just come back so filled with that. But in my case, I learned to keep my mouth shut as much as possible because I don't want to influence the people I'm with. I don't want to influence the people I'm researching, the people I'm talking to.
Is it easy to sway them?
I didn't try. Because I wanted my work to be as pure and as open as I possibly could make it. So I didn't even try. But within myself, what was propelling me was the words I received in my third near-death experience. That's when that very, very special voice spoke to me. And it wasn't like an angel or a guide or guardian it wasn't the typical kinds or even atypical kinds of voices. No, it was a voice like it filled the entire universe. It was so big. How do you describe that kind of bigness? And that voice said to me, and I quote, test revelation. You are to do the research, one book for each death. Then it showed me what that meant. Book one was not named, but I really feel that was the book coming back to life. Book two was named, that's future memory. And that book is out.
Mm-hmm.
And then book three was a special kind of manual that I'm now finally working on. So, you know, when I revived, there was that voice and that strength and that power and that that pulse within me. You are to do the research. One book for each death. And it was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, of course, that got me started, because that first year, you're dealing with it. You know, you're dealing with what happened to you. You're dealing with your body. And it was the next year when I was reasonably human again that, it was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. So I started out, you know, I'm a cop's kid. I was raised in a police station.
Yep.
So I used that as my protocol. Dad always said, the body tells you more than the mouth does. So you're watching bodies. I'm an observer. So I'm watching every nuance of the bodies and eyes and gesture and, you know, what is the individual doing as I'm speaking to them, if somebody else walks by.
Hold on for a second, PMH. We're going to take a break, but we're going to come right back and talk more about your work, Dying to Know You, on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest tonight, PMH Atwater, and we're going to take calls with her next hour. here on Coast to Coast AM. I've got a whole bevy of questions still to ask her when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. PMA Chatwater with us. It is amazing how many people, as they get older in their lives, PMH, they become interested in afterlife stories. And there was one. Tell me about the story of Walter Russell. Do you have that one?
I don't have it right in front of me, but I can tell you offhand that Walter Russell had his first near-death experience at the age of 7. I think it was high fever or something like that. He had his second one at the age of 14.
Jeez.
Every 7 years, he had another near-death experience until the age, I believe, of 39, when he went completely into light. He was there for almost a month. In fact, I think it was more than a month. In and out of this incredible light. When he came back, he was almost not functional. He couldn't even hold a pencil. And his family thought he was had gone over the hill. He was crazy, so they wanted to commit him to a psychiatric ward. Somehow he escaped that. And over the years, more and more and more of what he saw and studied and learned and was open to on the other side came through. And he started writing these books. And his book, The Universal One, I would recommend to anybody on the planet. That book describes creation, all of the elements, everything about creation to the nth degree, and it is, and it has graphs, it has drawings in it. He believed that the universe is a thought universe, that it's all propelled by thought. And controlled and, you know, runs on thought, a thought wave universe. And his book, The Secret of Light, there's a number of his books that are just awesome. They're absolutely awesome, even today. He wrote at the time to Einstein. Einstein and he went back and forth and back and forth. He challenged Einstein on several of his theories, and he has since, over time, turned out to be right. He also was able to transmute elements. We talk about alchemy. This man was doing it. One of his experiments was tested by a federal lab. I have seen the lab report. He actually did it. The things that this man did are awesome, and it all came from what was revealed to him in his near-death experiences since the age of 7.
Amazing.
I truly, and I talk a lot about his experience, of course, in the book, Dying to Know You, Proof of God, in the near-death experience. And if you want to talk about amazing cases, I would say that Walter Russell is the most powerful, the most amazing, the most incredible case that anyone has yet found.
Is he still alive?
Oh, no, he passed away quite some time ago.
He did, all right.
But his work remains, his book remains. You can still get them. And I do have a number of his books, especially The Universal One. You just open it up, and you're awed right there. You know, you just read one page, and it's just like, whoa.
Yeah. He pulls you.
How any one human being could have gotten all of this in you know, in a few days, a few weeks. It's just, wow. And we do have some wow cases, certainly. And I talk about some of that in the book, in the sense of what the people are saying about what has happened to them. And you get this, you get these stories, these cases. Many of them come from birth trauma. I'm amazed of the people who don't realize that a near-death experience can happen to anyone at any age. That means birth trauma. That means before birth. That means a baby, a toddler. And when they're old enough, they can talk about it. And what they talk about, what they act out, what they draw, is just, it shocks their parents. Much less the doctors. The youngest case that I've found in my research was 7 months in utero. Now we're talking the third trimester. We're talking at a time when science and medicine says that a baby about 7 months in utero can now feel pain as if a birthed baby. What my work suggests is that the brain comes online about then. And in my the larger book, the encyclopedia of the near-death experience, it's called The Big Book of Near-Death Experiences, I have a section in that book called Womb with a View.
I love that.
Because there's a lot of kids who are saying things to their parents that it shocks their parents. I call it the oops factor. Let's say, for instance, an abortion. A lot of aborted babies come back in their mother's near-death experience. Even in the father's near-death experience, aborted babies can come back. Missing twins come back. All these things are in this little bitty book. You know, people are talking about what really happened to them and how it affected them. And we've got to look at this, not the researcher. That, you know, Dying to Know You is not a research book. It's not a personal story. It's not a religious book. It's not a spiritual book. It's not an opinion piece. It is the collective speaking as a collective about the collective experience. And they're talking about mission and God and soul and life and death and heaven and hell and the big picture. And they're giving us all these gems, whether we want to hear it or not, whether we want to see it or not. They're redefining for us what we think we know.
Let me ask you this, though, because with all this afterlife discussion, after death, what about evil? What about, you just mentioned hell very briefly. What do you think all that is?
What do I think all that is? Well, let me talk about heaven and hell.
All right.
And
the distinction, of course.
It seems as if once you die, you're faced with or become aware of what I call a layer cake of levels and dimensions. And there are some levels that are dense and heavy. There are some levels that are very fine and very uplifting. We call the uplifting ones heaven. We call the dense ones hell. in all of the people that I've talked to, been aware of, even other researchers and their work that I'm aware of, there seems to be no bottom and no top to this layering. So, and all the layers seem to be separated by frequency of vibration, there's a different frequency, or the frequency changes. It's like I counted like 12 heavens, 12 hells, and you go, once you die, to wherever level you resonate. When we're talking about resonate, we're talking about the deepest level within you, who you really are at your core level, who you have builded yourself to be. It's not your opinion of yourself or who you think you are, but who you really are at your deepest level. That's your resonance factor. That's your vibration. And you go to that particular level on the other side where you fit, whether it's the finer vibrations or the more dense vibrations. So the idea then that you don't rot forever in hell, you don't stay forever on a cloud playing a harp in heaven. There's no top and there's no bottom, but there's movement. There's constant movement in this arrangement or in this process or in this construct. And that movement is your choice. It's based on your choice. You can wake up at any time. You can learn. You can progress. You can move. So it's not an idea that you're going to stay forever in one level. So when we're talking about evil, when you talk to an experiencer, they're going to talk in terms of your choices got you there. Who and where you are inside of your mind, inside of your deepest self, that's what took you there. And you don't have to stay there. Anyone can change. So how do we handle what's done unto us, whether it's wartime, whether it's abuse, whether it's murder? How do we handle that? And the experiencers, almost to a person, says that somehow this has to do with the energy factor that is present then.
Don't you think someone, PMH, if they don't believe, if they're not convinced of this existence, that their life is somewhat empty, can they actually go through life and feel good about it?
Well, some do. Some do. Huh. Some feel very good about the way they live. There doesn't have to be any kind of deity or any kind of afterword. They're very happy with the life that they're living, or at least they're very accepting of the life mm-hmm. that they're living. But if you compare them with someone who has a reason for life, who has a zest for life, who has a goal or a purpose in life, you compare those lives, and it's like, whoa, you really can't compare them. You know, it's like the difference between day and night. And you get an experiencer. Well, let me give you an example.
Sure.
This guy in Chicago. We're going back to Chicago. And
dress warmly.
Yeah, especially now. He was more of a mafia type. And when I met him, he was talking about his near-death experience. And he had His life review was the larger part of his experience. And his life review was extremely radical. We get some of the radical ones. They're not all pleasant. This idea that you're watching your life review, your life pass before your eyes, or you're reliving it again, whatever type you got, the idea that it's objective and painless and you're, looking for what you can learn from that, what you can correct, they're not all like that. Some of them are painful and some of them are very radical. And this guy had one of the radical ones where he had to live through any pain he caused anybody else. Plus, he also had to live through the pain and despair that his deed caused the relatives and friends of the people he hurt. So it's a double-decker. And he came back so traumatized that all he could do was help people in a church serve the needy.
It made him a better person, didn't it?
Well, in his case, he wanted somehow to make up for what he had done. And he was just so traumatized that he couldn't live any other way except to help the needy. So this idea of evil, there seems to be reasons for that. And you get at those reasons in near-death experiences, almost to a person. They're shown why Uncle George lost his arm or why Great Aunt Tilly had an abortion. You get the whys. You understand why the war. You understand why the rape. You understand the whys in life.
Why can't people understand that before they have this experience?
You don't want to see it, or you have no idea that there could even be a why. It's just, the thought that there could be any kind of reason behind what happened to you is the furthest thought from your mind with most people. But when you go through experiences like this, it's like everything is brought to bear. You face it again, and you realize there really are reasons. There really is a why, and you're so affected. In the book, I'd like to share with you a brief passage from the book.
Let's do that when we come back. We're already at the top of the hour,
and we'll
be back. Oh, it's going by fast. PMH Atwater with us, her latest work, Dying to Know You, and when we come back, more questions with her. And, of course, your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.